Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio. Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the leaders, clinicians, CEOs, founders and investors in the health tech space, the people that are really driving the healthcare revolution in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners of the show will know, I am a founder and CEO of a health tech venture myself called PocDoc. PocDoc support the show, so thank you very much to everyone from PocDoc. We at PocDoc are driving a mission towards hugely increasing access to cardiovascular disease testing and screening with our Healthy Heart Check. In under 10 minutes, you can get the equivalent of an NHS health check using your phone, including full cholesterol results. If you'd like more information, please head to pocdoc.co, P-O-C-D-O-C.co. Thanks as ever to everybody who's listening live on the amazing UK Health Radio. We really appreciate Johan and his team giving us the live platform every week. Thank you also to everyone who is listening on demand on any of the podcast channels or watching on YouTube, or who's recently watched any of our shorts that we've been putting out on YouTube and on Instagram. We really appreciate you guys joining, stopping by. As ever, you know, we continue to grow and we've got listeners now in over 50 countries every month, which is incredible. And we are in the top 10 podcasts of medicine and health in the UK, which is amazing. So thank you very much to everyone for that. Also, please make sure you check out all of the other shows on UK Health Radio, either live or on the UK Health Radio podcast channel. They are all there and there's some amazing people doing some amazing shows. So, on to today's show. Right, today's show. Today's show, we have Liam Cahill, who is the founder of Together Digital. Liam is truly a visionary, and I do mean this. Liam is truly a visionary in digital healthcare strategy, both on the side of innovative companies, for example, PocDoc and many others, as well as healthcare systems like the NHS. That's what makes someone like Liam very unique, is that they have skills and experience on working on both sides of those things, because it's very complicated. Liam has often been described as the hidden hand behind many of the successes of a number of innovative companies currently working and scaling with the NHS. And he himself actually has scaled a business within the NHS to achieve 100% market share. So every single NHS trust across the country worked with Liam when he ran that business, which is an incredible feat. So on to today's show, we're going to try and get into some of these issues around the NHS. Obviously, the headlines are bad. Is it all that bad? What are some of the things that people should know about the NHS but don't? And some of the insights that Liam's managed to glean from his amazing career. So Liam, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I feel a bit heavier than I did 4 days ago before the Easter eggs were handed out.
Hold on a minute. I have got some sound issues. Give me 1 second. Liam, what would be great while I try and sort my sound issues out? Would you be able to just give everyone a little couple of minutes about who you are and how you came to be doing all the incredible things you're doing while I try and sort out my sound?
Yeah, sure. Happy to riff it. My name's Liam. I have worked in and around the NHS for almost 2 decades now. I'm not entirely sure when my 20-year anniversary comes up, but it's trucking ahead really quickly. I've spent many years in the system driving sort of IT change and changing pathways. And as Steve alluded to, I spent the 2010s building up a social enterprise that spun out of the NHS that helped the NHS to change their pathways and improve both the the value of care and the quality of care, but also try to address cost efficiencies in the post-financial crash crisis. Over the last 5 to 6 years, I have worked on two areas, and I'm sure we'll probably go into it into the show in a bit more detail, Steve, but I work with a number of system providers at a national level, local level, and also providers themselves. And I am also working with health tech companies, and I think I've worked about 30 health tech companies over the year in order to help them with their digital, with their journey into the NHS. So I've worked with NHS England, a number of thought leaders such as the Health Foundation and other organizations.
So that is all very helpful, and thank you very much for leaping in and saving me. I'm going to apologize to everyone when I try and sort my situation out. So it might be a little bit patchy to begin with. So apologies if the quality is bad. I am about to try and plug my mic back in. But thank you very much for coming on the show. Liam and I have known each other for a while, and I've wanted to get him on the show for a number of reasons. I think the first is, like, as I said, Liam's in a really unique position, or you're in a really unique position. I think, Liam, having worked extensively on both within the system, but also with businesses looking to try and get into the system. And so what was it like when you started that company that you then scaled to working with all of the NHS trusts? Like, because that was an incredible journey for you. It must have been an incredible journey.
Yeah. Like, as someone who was in their sort of mid-20s, who was given a lot more responsibility by a portion of the NHS. I will make it clear that the organization that I built was a spin out from the NHS. So we had a couple of years as a program within one of the strategic health authorities. And then over time, we became a bit too big and maybe a bit too risky for the NHS, and then grew that to scale across the NHS. The NHS is, like, to everybody I work with, I think, having worked in the NHS for a number of years, I think the NHS is beautiful, but I'm a systems thinker. I absolutely love the complexity of the system and all of the different elements that kind of come together to bring together health and social care for so many different people in so many different areas. And so for me, I think the journey was trying to understand that the hidden waves and nuances that happens in the NHS, and try to understand the dynamics that work, because I think there's a lot of noise in the system, and it's very difficult to be able to make big business decisions based on all these different things you hear, rather than what's meaningful and what matters. And I think, you know, to bring it down into a nutshell, my journey was around trying to be able to sort of translate between that noise and what really matters in order to be able to work with local organizations. It was a fantastic journey, and the organization's still going strong. It's still part of the national community.
What did it do?
So the organization, blame me for the name, was called Prescript. So it was a prescribing quality, innovation, productivity and prevention initiative. And you live with the consequence of your name.
That's a mouthful, isn't it? What was that? Prescription quality prescribing community.
So we were called Prescript, which no one could spell, no one could say, right? But effectively, it was about driving. So in 2010, there was a big initiative across the NHS. Anyone who was in the NHS in like 2010 to like 2015 shudders when they think about QUIP, because it was basically the coalition government came in. They were trying to really push sort of like not spending any more money in a system with increasing demand and with increasing general costs as well. So we were called Prescript, and absolutely terrible name, but it's still there with that name, and that's what we ended up with.
Wow. Okay. And what did it do?
That was the question you asked, wasn't it? I've been trying, because I can see you during this, and I'm trying not to look at all the mic issues that were there before. So, like,
what? There's no mic issues. No
hand gestures. No. What we did was so all of the different areas in the NHS were working on their own, basically as little silos of activity. And what they would generally be doing is they would decide their prescribing policies that they would be, or their pharmacy policies around medicines and devices, around what they would choose to be used within different areas. Now, the government at the time said, hey, let's save a load of money. And what they generally do is they go and look at the things in the local area that people thought were important. But actually what they weren't using was national data, national information to say, well, actually, maybe we have an eminent clinician who's into diabetes who says this is what we should do. But actually, we're in the top 10% in the country, and there's less to be squeezed around that. So what we did is we tried to work as a collective investment pot spun out as a social enterprise, where we would try to work democratically amongst all the different areas to prioritize a number of areas where we would build evidence-based medicines, pathways and information and advice and guidance that could be used by the general practitioners. We built out all the data and BI systems back in the day that they could use with their GPs to say, well, actually, we can save 100 million or 50 million in our area if we switch this to this or we don't do this. And then we had e-learning platforms that we built over time. We had innovation awards that we did for them. We had an annual event to bring together the whole community. I suppose one of the things that a lot of our stuff was about application in practice, but the thing I think that was interesting is that a lot of innovation was happening in the community. You'd get one area that would do something in Cornwall, but because of the fragmented nature of the NHS, it would take like 10, 11 years to get up to somewhere in the north of England because there just isn't that way of sharing the information around. So having a way where we could almost become a centralized place where that community existed, we managed to kind of get that to about 2 to 3 years in sharing things. So we had an innovation awards where people would share their ideas and then that would go across to different areas. And we did a whole number of different things. Like part of the national policy around medicines is around low value medicines. And we actually came up with all of that. And that ended up being announced by Simon Stevens in, I think, 2017, 2018, which I think was intending to help save the NHS around 250 to 300 million pounds a year.
Using cheaper versions of similarly efficacious products.
Yeah. But basically, there's a number of things on the NHS have been that were when the NHS wasn't so financially constrained that people were just prescribing over time. So, you know, I think some of them were quite contentious. So, for example, the NHS was spending like tens and tens and tens of millions of pounds a year on gluten-free food prescribing. And obviously, when the cuts came into the system,
I didn't know they could do that. Is that
well? They did. They did back then. Yeah. So you'd have people who would be getting like food, pizza, but they'd be getting prescribed like pizza bases, not even always healthy food. They'd be getting like flour and stuff so they could feed their family. Yeah.
Where did they get that fulfilled? Did the pharmacy, how did they go?
Bags of flour and stuff would be sent through to the pharmacy at a really high cost. So, you know, one of the things is if you go in and get gluten-free food now and it's generally sort of, you know, it's available everywhere and it's pretty sort of cost effective. But we were paying like £10 as taxpayer. We were paying about a tenner for a bag of flour. I can't remember the exact number, but it was like really, really expensive. Then you add in all the supply chain costs and so on. And there was a lot of money being spent in the system. So we had this whole basket of about 20 or 30 areas where it just shouldn't be prescribed in an NHS that was trying to save money, because otherwise the money would be taken from somewhere else where there's actually higher value interventions.
Okay. And you mentioned something to say that you guys were involved with the kind of pushing or development or sort of rollout of evidence-based medicines or evidence-based prescriptions, I guess. Isn't all prescription evidence-based? What do you mean by that? I think it's useful just to clarify for everyone listening.
So it's an interesting topic. Evidence is quite subjective. Like, we have an NHS where I think as the population, we believe that things are built on evidence. We believe that evidence exists. But like, you know, like when, for example, we would get evidence. So we were very involved with the pharmaceutical companies who'd be pushing, like we weren't paid by them. We were absolutely NHS funded. We never took any money from the NHS, from the pharmaceutical companies. But what they'd do is they'd come and say, well, actually, like, hold on, you're not prescribing our thing, which is totally different in your pathway. And when you looked into their studies, it would be like, based off a rat study. Now, arguably, a rat study is evidence, but do we really want to be them going to a GP and saying, actually, you can prescribe this too? What then? Because we've got evidence-based studies, when actually the evidence-based studies for, you know, one of them is 1,000 rats and the other one is like, you know, 1,000 people who've actually gone through a really detailed trial. So I think evidence is a very fluid term. And I think, you know, in this day and age, there's lots of things that we know are good interventions that aren't evidence-based, such as, I'm going to call it for my partner, but osteopathy. Osteopathy is one of those things where it's very hard to be able to say evidence, but osteopathy is in the UK. It? Yeah.
Really? It's hard to evidence the value, is it?
Well, there aren't huge multinational corporations. I mean, I don't want to get conspiracy here, but there aren't multinational. Like, the problem that we have with the evidence-based system here, right? The problem that we have with the evidence-based system is that generally there's such a high bar for evidence. And actually, I think this might dovetail onto health tech if we get into that, right? But like, because there's such a high bar for evidence.
It might be a good idea at some point, but let's carry on. I don't want to create a precedent on talking about health tech on this show, but
We'll find a way.
Yeah.
But like, you know, like, you know, if you think about, for example, NICE guidance, and you think about all of the things that are required to go through the pipeline for medicines. And, you know, I think like that has set a precedent for what we expect a degree of evidence to be. So generally, if you want something to be considered as high evidence, it will be peer reviewed in the Lancet or the BMJ. Yeah. It will be this. And this takes many years, significant cost that actually
there's
other things where, you know, particularly since we're talking so much nowadays about digital health interventions, you know, we do have a system which is largely built. The system of evidence is largely built based on the pharmaceutical pharmacological model. Whereas actually, yeah, there's lots of other things out there that nobody has a huge budget and the energy to go through huge trials with placebos and stuff to say this is better than this. Yeah. So, you know, evidence is an interesting topic, and spending 10 years in that world, it's, you know, I guess it sort of turned me from seeing things as black and white to seeing things as very grey in the middle. You know, it all depends
over that
on
period of time,
who's behind it. Yeah.
Over that period of time, like, what was how did your view of the NHS or of the problems facing the NHS change, develop, evolve? You know, did it, were there situations where there, you know, with the change of government, there was a huge shift, or I don't know, how did things, because you were involved in that for what, 8 years, 10 years? How long were you involved in that process? Well, quite a while, right?
That was an 8-year journey. Yeah. It was a very interesting journey at the time, because we went from primary care trusts and, you know, sort of a very different system to a very contentious and very confusing set of reforms with the Landsley reforms, which introduced competition and the principle of like local GPs taking control of clinical commissioning groups and so on. So like, yeah, like when I was a bright-eyed and bushy-tailed sort of 25-year-old who was asked to kind of take on the operational responsibility, I will say I was the COO, not the CEO. It was led by a clinician. Like, as you know, like, I think I saw the NHS like many see the NHS, which is that it was probably logical and sensible, and that actually it was probably doing everything it could do to make things work. And I guess what our organization did is we kind of became sort of like an anti-institutional thing. You know, we sort of became a cultural change because we were a bottom-up grassroots community, and we changed a lot of how things work. And we, it really helped me see that the NHS is a human, imperfect and dysfunctional system with lots of people trying their best, but it's very, very complex, but that it is understandable. So I guess seeing the difference between thinking, well, everybody must have an answer, it must all work, to going, well, actually it manages to work, but there isn't necessarily that level of intention that goes with it, really helped me shift how I think about the system.
Right. It's not malicious. There's no, it is the way it is.
It's a complex system where no one individual or one group can grasp all of the different specific mechanics of it. Yeah.
Right. And presumably no one group can affect change on the whole system either, by very definition.
No. That is, yeah, even the CEOs of organizations struggle to be able to make significant changes. I work with CEOs, and it's very difficult for them to enact change.
You mean, like, yeah, for example, a CEO of one of the clinical commission groups or a trust or something?
Yeah. Like, the way that I like to think about the NHS, or I explain to it, is like people think that it's one thing, but actually what it is to me is it's like some kind of feudal Italian city state with lots of power dynamics and groups where it all kind of manages to work.
Right.
But ultimately the level of downward control doesn't exist in the same way that we may think it does.
Or and when you say we, not just people on the street, but also I think potentially politicians from time to time.
Politicians, people in NHS England, like a lot of people within the system who are new to it, a lot of people who are trying to sell to the system, the general public. Like, we have a very specific view of what the NHS is. Like, it's one thing. Like, the NHS is a concept. It's not actually an organisation in itself. Yeah, the majority of organisations in the NHS are actually private sector organisations, because GPs and pharmacies are. And they do 90% of the patient contacts.
Which I don't think people realise. They're all private businesses. So we're going to go for our first commercial break, and then we'll be back, hopefully completely without any mic or sound issues, for the second part of this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roos, and my guest, Liam Cahill, the founder of Together Digital and a visionary within digital healthcare strategy as far as the NHS goes. Anyway, we'll be back after 2 minutes.
the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to the second part of this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest, Liam Cahill. So, Liam, where I'd like to move this discussion on, you know, without being too controversial, is into the area of health and technology, and to try and sort of get under the skin a bit more from a, I would think, from the concept of innovation and innovative businesses launching in the NHS, kind of overlaid with this sort of media narrative that is pretty constant at the moment, let's be honest, about how terrible everything is in the NHS. I can't remember a positive NHS story off the top of my head that's hit the mainstream media in well, I can't remember one, to be quite frank. I think it seems to me that there are sort of two types of stories that really hit the mainstream media. One is how bad everything is at the NHS: waiting lists, GP appointments, misdiagnoses, all that stuff. The other thing that seems to get some coverage is innovation XYZ has launched to be able to do this, and there doesn't seem to be much in the middle. So I don't know why don't we start with talking through what's your perception of the issue, of the real issues that are going on in the NHS at the moment, and potentially how they impact the adoption of innovation? Because the waiting list is a symptom; it's not necessarily the real issue at the heart of things.
It's such a big and complex area, so I'll try and pick a couple of the I think, you know, I'm someone who teaches innovation. I teach it to people in the NHS, teach it to folks in the armed services, and I teach around sort of disruption. Like, I think the first thing is just an acknowledgement of where we are, right? Like, we are going into a new age in society. You know, we are going into a digital industrial revolution, and digital industrial revolutions, as they happen, require us to think and act differently. And I suppose we have a very ongoing and standard model of thinking that happens in the NHS, and that is generally that we have institutions at the top who will define what happens locally, who will then define what happens in providers, who will then define what happens in patient care. And when we had the Lansley reviews between sort of 2013 and 2021, there was a separation of church and state. You know, the NHS was given a huge amount of independence. And quite often in the news, you would hear Simon Stevens, the then chief executive of the NHS, being very forthright in his views as an independent entity with NHS England. In the last reform, we had a number of changes that were positive. So, the idea of integrated care systems and integration, mm-hmm. or organisations working together, is one that is an international theme. Most areas that are trying to be progressive, like the Netherlands, for example, did it 7 years ago, and it's been really successful for them. But we've had a number of these changes where there's really positive elements, but one of the biggest elements that we've had, to me, is that we've sort of removed that sort of stopgap between church and state. So by church, what I mean is the politicians, the health secretary and the various undersecretaries that work there. Now, what that is often meaning is that we're getting a lot of responsiveness from the politicians who then run into NHS England. I have lots of friends who worked in Department of Health and NHS England, who are then basically running around trying to keep health secretaries happy. What they then do is they create short-term targets. They create specific areas where they start micromanaging local systems. And this grand experiment that we have around integration gets almost distorted, and people can't really focus on doing the work that matters. So I think one of the biggest symptoms that I see in this health system at the moment, and like, this isn't just me. So for example, the Right Honourable Patricia Hewitt was brought in a couple of years ago, and she wrote a report. And basically the TLDR of her recommendations was NHS England needs to lead the local systems to actually improve care and not be constantly micromanaging them, and less targets and stuff like that. Like, realistically, you know, in our organizations, in the workplace that any of your listeners will be in, like, it's a pretty obvious statement that we can't innovate if we're being micromanaged, because micromanagement is not safe. And safety is what we need to come up with ideas, to take a risk and try new things. And right now in this NHS, we have some really extreme factors that are going on. So, you know, we have a workforce crisis where, like, you know, we have what's called in systems thinking a sort of a problematic loop. And basically the problematic loop is we have such a stressful environment with the conditions that don't make people happy. All of the pressure basically means that people leave, which increases the stress and the problems, which means that more people leave. And that is effectively like a vicious cycle that is getting worse and worse. Similarly, we have a funding cycle where money that is being put into people waiting, the longer they wait, the more complex and the more care that they need. And then the waiting lists get longer. So if we see in the news, the waiting lists are getting longer and longer because actually they're taking more time to treat as they come in. And this sort of pandemic hangover means that we've got this area that we could put more resource and energy in order to improve. But we're in another vicious cycle where this is continually sort of, you know, going down and down, you know, and there's a number of areas where we're seeing this. We're seeing this in general practice, and we're reading in the news about GPs all the time. And so amongst all of this environment, what we have is just intervention, intervention, intervention. And, you know, you hear lots of heroic health secretaries coming in and saying, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that.
Well, we're going to make a certain amount of millions available to solve this.
Yeah, yeah. But the reality is that if we undermine it environmentally and culturally, like how many times do we see in the news about toxic culture? Who innovates in a toxic culture? Who feels that they can innovate, that they can take a risk or take a leap? Nobody does. And so, you know, we can look at the circumstantial things that are going on, and they're super important. Like, we really need to invest in prevention. It's the only way that we can make the system better. And we have to think differently around prevention. But prevention is a theme. You know, it's something where we just act earlier. But if we're talking specifically about innovation, we have huge times. Like, this is getting worse and worse. And when we look at where innovation has happened in extreme circumstances, like during world wars and stuff like that, where you see huge cycles.
Or during the pandemic, there was quite
during the pandemic, exactly. Probably a much more recent one than
1939.
Yeah,
we can go back if you want, or we can go back just a couple of years, or we can go back 60. I don't mind.
Okay, right. So I won't go back to
go
a few hundred years. Yeah. But you know, when we have these very extreme times, it leads us to be able to take the shackles off and innovate. You know, and what the story of the pandemic was a great story, because what we did is we trusted people, we let people get stuff done. But what's happening since is we're just getting in their way all the time. And so for me, I think innovation in the NHS, whether it's digital and technological or non-digital and technological, is the more that we hamstring people and put shackles on them culturally, the more cultural toxicity and micromanagement and control that is being added, the less likely we are to step up and innovate for these huge times that we have now.
So what should, in your opinion, what should the role of the health secretary be? Because there's always going to be a health secretary. Always, I suspect, you know, until such time as we reach this utopia of, I don't know, you know, no one needing a government, which I don't know if we'll ever get to. And then what should the role of NHS England be? When was NHS England created? How long has it been there for? When did it start?
Ooh, that's a good question.
What was its original mission?
Well, before we were born, Steve.
Okay.
Yeah, but, you know, I think if we look at the original mission of the system, NHS England was not needed as much, right? So if, for example, you read some of the writings of an author called Hilary Cottam in Radical Help, what she talks about is when we created the NHS, when sort of, you know, Beveridge and Bevan created the NHS sort of in the post-war you know, circumstances, healthcare was you get sick, you go to hospital, you die or you get better. This concept of long-term and lifestyle conditions didn't really exist. Like, having somebody constantly on your books for decades and decades with multi-morbidities, lots of different conditions, it didn't really exist. And generally, as long in the system, you know, in NHS England or the national bodies, like that you would, what they would do is they would come and they would set the conditions so they can operate effectively. The problem we have now is we have these people who are getting, you know, who are getting lifestyle conditions younger and younger, and there's more and more of them. Like, this is a constant global growth pattern. and we don't know how, we don't know what to do with them. Like there's a Tory there's a sort of a Tory lord who I can't remember his name, but he says that actually, if we're entirely honest, we're a national sickness service, not a national health service. We deal with people when they're sick, and we don't really have anything to help them get healthy. And now I think this is the thing that, like, if we look at what NHS England's now, it's a group that is trying to tackle these things that have long, long-term consequences. It's not you get sick, you live and you die. Like when people got tuberculosis, that wasn't, you didn't, prevention didn't happen in the same kind of way. I digressed into that, but what do we need? Lead a health secretary. So I like to think it's pretty simply, right? Rather than like, is nowadays, if we read any, if you pick up any book about good leadership is servant leadership, right? Mm-hmm. It is about enabling and empowering people. And if, for example, you look at some of the most successful health initiatives that exist on the planet, they generally have huge amounts of agency. They have a mission, and they have trust, and they have relative freedom to be able to do it, to do the right thing rather than a very specific siloed thing. So the first thing I would do if I were to be able to write the job description of a health secretary, which would be fun, is to try and sort of limit that so we don't have constant knee-jerk reactions that are going downwards that are distracting. So firstly, we need to, you know, that would be around setting the conditions for the system. I would re-add in church and state so they have a degree of separateness, so they don't have total control. Like, don't have the leaders of NHS England sat in their office so they can come and tell them off, you know, right. which is a thing. So, you know, and so in terms of this, I would be trying to see how we can deinstitutionalize the top and how we'd be trying to push things further down so we can actually empower local organizations, local providers and local systems to do the right thing.
How do you, in a service that's so complex, how does it end up with just one person? It kind of ends, the peak of the pyramid, so to speak, is the health secretary. Yeah. So how is it even feasible for that person to affect any change on the system? I guess that's my question.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Beyond just random initiatives that they just happen to get behind and, you know, get pushed. Yeah. I mean, how can that one person really do much?
And if we think, who is that one person? Right. And, you know, like seeing some interesting things come through from the health secretary. Obviously, Jeremy Hunt is not the health secretary, he's the chancellor, and he's the one who's got a lot of noise recently. But the current health secretary, before she came into health, has no health background. No. She hasn't come into a health role. So realistically, we brought in an upper chief executive with no experience in probably one of the most complex human systems imaginable in society.
I've got to believe it's the toughest bridge. Treasury's tough. Obviously, I think the home sec's really hard, but in terms of actual sheer complexity and difficulty, it's got to be the NHS.
Yeah, totally. It's not top down in the same way that the others work. It's a very, very complex system. And as someone who spent 20 years and like, what I love about the NHS is that I've been like, I'm like a squirrel. I love collecting information about the, like we work together. You know what I'm like, right? I love all of the different nuances and I get really excited about them. The nuggets of the NHS, right? And how you connect them all together. But that 20 years, I feel like I'm only scratching the surface. Like I really feel like there's so much. And imagine just on day one, if I just came in now, I didn't have any experience of health. And then I started moving the pieces of the system around.
Or at least trying to, right? And sort of like, say, when you get into the role, it's going to be like, well, we need more doctors. Okay, that's really difficult. Okay, we need to stop people leaving. Okay, well, that's really hard to do as well. And we need to pay them more. We don't have any more money. I mean, it must just be very difficult to do.
Like, also, I think also it's like, not every intervention is the same, right? So there's a systems thinker called Donella Meadows, really fantastic systems thinker. And what she writes about is basically sort of like leverage points in the system. And the concept of this is that there's different things that you can do that you don't always have the same kind of yield, right? Now, there's the pieces on the deck chair. So we pick point at a target or we change something, but it doesn't materially change how the system's working. Nothing really changes. But if you think about the really big stuff that happens, like the paradigms in the system, the held truths that are maybe getting in our way, some of the really big strategic targets that are long-term, that have to be culturally embedded in people's hearts and minds. Like, that work isn't short-term work. That's long-term and consistent work, and requires a real understanding, because otherwise we just create, we put in solutions and we create more problems as a result.
You're just creating slogans each year.
Yeah.
You're just, it's like, this year's slogan is, you know, whatever it is, innovate to succeed. Next year's slogan is, you know, patient at the heart of everything, whatever, you know, it doesn't mean anything.
No, it doesn't.
So what have you, let's talk a little bit about the how does innovation thrive in this environment? Or how does it begin to thrive and not get stifled by the kind of sheer overwhelming complexity of this system? Because it can, and it does.
It's a great question. And to be honest, if there's one thing that I'm devoting my career to, it's to answering that question. And so, like, for me, you know, I've worked with frontline providers where I've been brought in to basically try and hold a space of safe experiments where frontline staff can do whatever they want to do in the interests of their patients, rather than something that's been downward pushed to them. And like, being able to give that freedom and to give the people who exist in the context of care the agency to make that change with the support and safeguards without interventions is how we get innovation to happen. Because we think about really complex areas of care. How do we change them from so high up, so many degrees of separation around it? It has to be the people in that system who need the space and freedom to allow that to happen.
And do they currently not have that, in your opinion? Or are they doing some places, doing others? It's a bit of a mix. Depends on the day. What's your kind of view on that?
Everyone's absolutely slammed. We just look in the news every single week. Cultural toxicity is the, like, if you Google hospitals, right, and you look for headline articles, it's always about, like, culturally toxic people who've, you know, whistleblowers who've had to whistleblow because they can't say that there's a problem. Like, not all organizations, I've worked with some fantastic organizations, but in many of them, that is the prevailing culture that we have. And people who move around the NHS maybe feel that it's not, like, they can't do that. They can't make a change.
Right. So they kind of just get discouraged.
Yeah.
Because agency isn't about, after this, we'll go to a break and we can continue this on afterwards. One of the myths, well, maybe it isn't a myth, I'm not sure. One of the kind, like you said, sort of accepted truths, if you like, is that money solves things in the NHS. So it's always a money issue. There's not enough money to do things. But agency isn't about money necessarily. And there are funding streams. There is money available to do different things. So do you think it's less about the money and more about the kind of culture of agency and facilitating it from the ground up?
Like, money helps. Like, you know, the rule of a digital champions program in the NHS is that if you can't pay to backfill, then no one will have the time to make the change and therefore nothing will happen. Right. But, like, you know,
wait, say that again. What was that?
Okay. If you don't put in the money to backfill time for individuals to do some innovation in a champions program, a digital champions program, where they get to just go and try and solve things, they don't have the time to solve things. And obviously, time is money in the NHS. And so money does lubricate things, but it's like the oil in the engine. It's not necessarily the engine. The engine are people. And the NHS has a constant workforce of many, many, many people who can solve problems if they're supported to. And if the right environment's there, they can probably solve a huge amount more without that much money. Like, when I'm working with organizations, I often say, look, money isn't your main problem. Like, there's a lot of things that you can do that will make you more innovative, will make you more successful, that doesn't really cost anything, which might be around making things safe to try.
Yeah. And so do you feel like the NHS can solve? Because I think there's also a bit of we're an external company that works with the NHS and believe that we're helping them solve a problem that otherwise they wouldn't be able to do so. But do you believe that there's the NHS should be able to solve more of its issues from the inside as opposed to looking externally? Or do you think that there's a happy medium where it can do both?
Like, I think when it comes to digital and technology, that the trend of all of society will be that outside and external organizations and parties will bring the technology to state provision. But there is a huge amount that can be done inside to make them be able to actually deliver it, to deliver it more efficiently, to be receptive, right, to bring it out in its best way.
It's
not one or the other, you know. It's not just that you stick, if you can get stick in technology, it'll change things. Behavioral change, people have to work differently for these things to actually be embedded, you know.
Yeah, that makes sense. But we'll pick this up after our final break. We will be right back with the third part of this week's show with Liam Cahill, founder of Together Digital. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest, Liam Cahill, the founder of Together Digital, which is one of the leading strategic consultancies that works together with the NHS and with innovative businesses to help them come together to scale innovation to solve patient problems in the UK. So, Liam, just before the break, you said something which I want to pick up on, which is that your life's mission is around helping businesses, innovative businesses, thrive within systems, and that's what you feel really passionate about. So could you elaborate a bit on that, and why do you feel so passionately about that, and how are you going about your mission?
So as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, I spend time inside the system. Like I spend, like when I'm introducing myself to people, I tend to say, with one hat I help people in the system not fall over themselves when trying to innovate. And then on the other hand, I help folks who are coming in and might therefore get into this circumstance where the NHS is falling over itself trying to innovate, and quite a cost to them. I passionately believe in the opportunity that this digital revolution that we're coming to brings. You know, I think there's a lot of noise in the media, particularly, you know, over the last couple of years of AI, around how it's all going to be grey and stuff like that. But then there's also a lot of sort of doomsaying about what it's going to be. I look at technology, and, you know, I'm a technologist, and I look at technology as both an inevitability and a choice. And we have the ability to choose what we want. And the relationship between people in the system trying to design the future of what we want the public service that we are recipients of to be, it's not just we get more technology, it's we try and imagine what better human relationships and systems are. Now, there is a very sort of big sort of cycle that goes between the system, what they are, suppliers, and then suppliers produce things for the system. And it's a really important relationship that we've probably not had in the past in the same way now. And so getting that right is fundamental. Like, I think we can all point to some of the dangers in society that come through technology. Like, you've just got to go online and like bounce around in the internet, and there's a whole load of really terrible stuff there that we don't want to be subjected to. And we don't want the same to be the case within health and social care too. But this requires us to be able to collaborate and have conversations between a system which can often be quite anti-private sector, it can often be quite resistant, reluctant to work with folks outside, even though they also know that they don't have the ability and time and resource to try and build different things that a market would do. But also we have, how do I say it? And the present company absolutely excluded, Steve. But like, we also have a technology culture and market which is very arrogant and often naive and thinks we're going to come in and revolutionize care. And then basically creates models that are not in the best interests of the system. So I don't know, like, I do so many different things.
Like ships in the night a little bit, right? There's like sort of things aren't necessarily meeting in the middle all the time.
I think particularly after the pandemic, there were a lot of companies who were going for the quickest and most profitable thing. And they thought, hey, the NHS is open for business, let's profit from it. And that didn't work out very well because the NHS wasn't as open for business as it thought it was. And it oversimplified a vision. But as soon as you get into system care, you know, as we know through our working together, it's very complex. And you've got to think about some really big, important things.
And very early. You have to think about them very early, which you don't.
Very early.
In other pathways, you don't have to think about those things as early as you do. Like in most other businesses, you really just focus on, will the end user buy this and use it in a singular instance? Will they, if I'm building a website that sells tickets, will they buy the tickets? Will they get the tickets? You know, I've got a website that sells t-shirts, same thing, t-shirts delivered, t-shirts bought. Whereas I think in health, you have to think through this sort of myriad of multiverse right at the very early stages, which becomes very difficult because you actually need to work with people to figure out how to solve the problems that you're being asked to solve before you can work with them.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there is a degree of polarization. I think a lot in tech, I've got a lot of friends who are, you know, run tech companies and again, present company excluded, who kind of feel that the NHS is just getting in their way and they're not helping them and all of this kind of stuff. And then you've got the NHS who are going, well, they're not building things for us. Like, we've got to find a way to work together because ultimately, you know, people in the system who sit in front of individuals with health conditions every day, who see what goes wrong if they get it wrong, and those who have the ability and capacity to build technology need to be able to try and have a discussion around what matters. And so what matters might be that the company coming in needs to think about the system, who's got targets from NHS England and how those relate to priorities, about the patient experience and the organization, the different kinds of providers and what they need to for it to work. And then also the other stakeholders that work around them who will be thinking about things like inequalities and thinking about digital exclusion and inclusion, and all of these different kinds of things. And if we've just got this big gap between us, then we're going to build the wrong thing. So if we try and reduce the gap and bring it together and have more open conversations, like the NHS should rightfully be slightly protective and guarded to make sure the wrong things don't come in. And a tech community that is willing to maybe accept that this is a longer, more complicated or complex thing than they maybe thought it was at the beginning, and have investors who are behind them willing to play a longer game to do the right thing, is what will get us into a better future. And so trying to facilitate that side of things and those discussions in the different areas I work is part of the big mission that I'm trying to bring, because I suppose sitting on both sides, I can see how often it's going wrong, and we don't have the time to get it wrong. We've got to get this right. We've got to make things better. Otherwise the NHS collapses, provision of it collapses.
Yeah. I mean, and you don't want a situation where innovative businesses don't try and work with the NHS, because that only serves to the detriment of the British population fundamentally. Mm. And you know, there's enough issues to overcome as a result of Brexit in that regard, due to medical device regulation and things like that, that's created downstream issues there. So what are some of the examples that you've either worked with or come across, without breaking any confidences, of things with that represent how things should be? So a successful collaboration between an external company and an internal team at the NHS with a shared vision, shared mission, delivered well, that has an impact.
So I suppose a lot of this kind of work happens on the system side. So when I'm working with tech companies, I will kind of coming in and providing guidance. So I'm kind of like a granddad nowadays. Well, I'm 42, so in fact I'm calling, and with a baby on the way, like, I shouldn't be calling myself a granddad. I've still got to get all my ducks out first, you know, before I start using that. But like, yeah. I think, like, you know, a lot of what I try to do is be quietly in the background, trying to help facilitate that conversation for those providers. And that's happened with a number of those companies. And so I think, you know, like, rather than focusing on one specific example on the tech company side, I get an immense amount of pride, when I've managed to help them really think about some of the bigger complexities of the system. And they've sat down, had a conversation, and the people in the system have gone, "You're speaking our language, we can talk, we can work together, we can have those conversations." And I've seen how, you know, a system where people come up and they're getting terminology wrong, or they're not thinking about really important elements, and they're kind of like, "We don't feel that you have the level of sophistication to work with us." When that has come, I've seen how much the relationship changes and how much trust has kind of led through to very specific examples. Working on the system side, like, you know, I tend to then be a bit more technology agnostic and tend to, you know, work in some different ways. But there was a wonderful example where a community health provider in South West London I was working with, I was given the ability and responsibility to, by the chief exec and the leadership team, to go in and basically help answer some really big questions around how they would use Microsoft 365. Now, Microsoft 365, if you're not aware of it, is a suite of different modular things that you can use in addition to like Excel and PowerPoint in your email. I'm trying to remember that we don't necessarily have an audience of entirely technologists, so I'm trying to make sure that my answer here is accessible. But actually, lots of different tools which are more general purpose tools that you can use. And in this organization, rather than kind of going, well, here's how it's going to be used, and this is all the stuff that you've got to do, and then everybody living with the consequences, we asked the biggest questions that we could think of. And what happened is the team's going, wait there, so we get to choose, suddenly led to them doing things that we never could have seen before. And there's a particular moment of pride, or like probably one of my proudest moments in my career, really, where, and it's a really small one, but where there was someone from a neurological disability service, so people with, really complex difficulties. And there was a particular individual, and someone had basically used a tool and built it for a very specific patient because she could and she saw a patient need. It was never on the strategic plans, but this individual had very high needs and was being supported by carers. And I sat down with her and we had this meeting. She was like, guess what I did yesterday? I've made someone's life better because I have this technology and I have the agency to do that. And I suppose that's where my moments have come in terms of doing this. Like, I think my role increasingly is to try and just help set up the conditions and facilitate the things. But when I see people in the system proudly being able, who maybe were very anti-technology before, proudly wanting to do and then achieving something that nobody up in maybe the iceberg of ignorance in the company or a national or local system would have done because they saw a patient need, that to me, that's the best moments. And that's what I aspire to, us being able to replicate more with technology. You know, somebody going, actually, technology is something I can use day to day to solve problems and change things. And I think technology is where we can use that to, how do you say, empower, not require compliance in the digital, in the technological workforce. And, you know, like, obviously, I know PocDoc and what you do. And I think one of the things I think is fantastic about PocDoc is that it's versatile. And there's so many different ways you can use it, and that a service can create something that really works around their patients. And I want to see more of those kind of tools like yours coming through. And so hopefully we'll be adding the future PocDoc to one of those success stories in the years to come.
Thank you very much. Well, look, that's the end of our show, I think. Just before we go, Liam, give us 1 minute on if you are working at an innovative company or founder of an innovative company that wants to work with the NHS, what would be the top 2 or 3 things that you would recommend very briefly?
The top 2 things that I would recommend. Firstly, starting with a problem, always starting with a problem and trying to go to a system that may not always know what the problems are, trying to make sure that you're articulating in the right way. I believe that we have too many focuses on solutions. Here's this thing, come and use it, rather than saying, here are the problems that you have and this is why they're meaningful, and trying to really relate to them where they are is really big. And also making sure that you take time to really outline your narrative for the NHS, because do you know what? The NHS is so overwhelmed at the moment. A bit of help around how they can tackle strategic problems that helps them to be able to kind of really improve their thinking is something that is really beneficial. And, you know, we should have an environment where all of these organizations in the NHS and outside can test and play with ideas so we can spark and come up with new things that we can create together.
Cool. That's very helpful. Liam, thank you so much for being on the show. Liam Cahill, founder of Together Digital. How do they find you, Liam, if people want to find you?
Oh, I'm all over LinkedIn. Search my name and you'll get loads of AI generated articles left, right and center in your face.
Brilliant. Well, look, and thank you very much to everyone for listening. We'll be back again next week with another show. Thank you very much.